in the 30s.
His second career was as a soldier. At the beginning of the war, he resigned from the Foreign Office and enlisted as a private in the Cameron Highlanders. In a few months, he was a captain, and at age 32, he was a brigadier. He was a member of the Special Air Services Regiment, which became famous for its operations behind the enemy lines in the Western Desert. He then commanded a detachment in southern Iran and was responsible for kidnapping a Persian officer who was rather too friendly with the Germans. Later, he was secretly dropped by parachute in German-occupied Yugoslavia as Mr. Churchill's personal representative. For his war service, he was awarded decorations by Marshal Tito, Soviet government, the Croix de Guerre by the French government, and the CBE by the British government. And in 1957, he was created a baronet. During this time, he also managed to carry on a third career as a politician, serving as a member of parliament from 1941 to 1974, and from 1954 to 1957 in the cabinet as Under Secretary of State for War. But most of us know him by his fourth career, that of author. His books include Disputed Barricade, A Person from England, Back to Bukhara, Yugoslavia, Concise History of Scotland, and Take Nine Spies. But his best known book remains his first, Eastern Approaches. The book describes his experiences in Russia as a young attaché at the British Embassy in Moscow in the 30s, and his adventures in the Western Desert, Persia, and Yugoslavia during the war. He gives an eyewitness account from the courtroom of the Stalin purge trials, which he was able to follow with his fluent Russian. Sir Fitzroy describes his highly unorthodox forays to the then unauthorized remote parts of Soviet Central Asia. He introduces us to those golden legendary places of Samarkand, Bukhara, Turkestan, and across the Oxus. Recently, he has written a series of books about the Soviet Union, which he has revisited many times. And his most recent book is called Holy Russia, which is also the title of his talk tonight. Sir Fitzroy MacLean.
Chairman, ladies and gentlemen, Winston Churchill once said that Russia was a riddle wrapped in a mystery inside an enigma. I yield to no one in my admiration of Sir Winston, but to my mind, he exaggerated the problem. The Russians have always enjoyed keeping the rest of the world guessing. Russia, wrote the Marquis de Custine back in 1839, is a country where everyone is part of a conspiracy to mystify, en guirlande, to mystify the foreigner. And I'm sure you all know the story of the French ambassador who, on being told that his Russian colleague had died, immediately asked, "What can his motive have been?" But in fact, there's nothing very mysterious or very hard to understand about the underlying motives of Soviet policy. Like that of most countries, it is based on more or less enlightened self-interest. The self-interest in this case of a superpower with, as its ultimate theoretical aim, world domination, or to put it in another way, world revolution. You may wonder why I've called my latest book and why I've chosen as a title for this talk, Holy Russia. I've been reading a lot of Russian history lately, and one thing that strikes me about it is the element of continuity, the similarity of Soviet Russia to Imperial Russia, to Holy Russia, as it was called, the similarity of Stalin's methods to those of Ivan the Terrible or Peter the Great, the continuing tradition of centralized control by the state, the insistence on orthodoxy, whether religious or ideological, the strong conservatism, the innate horror of subversive or unorthodox ideas, and finally the continuing family resemblance between Soviet and Tsarist foreign policy. Of course, there have been enormous changes. The revolution has given a new dimension to Russian policy, but certain factors remain constant. Russia's geographical position, her climate, the enduring effects of the Mongol conquest, the national character and traditions of the Russian people. Indeed, many of the changes brought about by the revolution have actually served to accentuate existing Russian characteristics, many of them going right back to the days of the Mongols. The centralist and bureaucratic tradition, the panic fear of unorthodoxy and contagion, the deep-seated suspicion combined sometimes with a blind adoration of everything foreign, and finally Russia's almost religious sense of imperial mission, her continuing urge to convert, enlighten, and reform. Domestic considerations weigh heavily with most governments, and Russia is no exception. Russia's never been an easy country to govern. As one pre-revolutionary Russian Prime Minister, Count Witter, put it, the world should be surprised not that we have a less than perfect government in Russia, but that we have any government at all. The amazing thing is that the country can be held together even by an autocracy. In Stalin's day, of course, power was concentrated in one man's hands, which saved a lot of time and trouble. Now this is no longer so. The system, rather than any one individual, has come to occupy the center of the stage. And within the system, there are now signs of varying shades of opinion, which means, whether those concerned like it or not, a measure of political and indeed economic interplay and compromise. As one well-qualified observer put it recently, Russian totalitarianism is often less than total. Now, this is a most important development. What it comes to is that however much they might want to do so, the present rulers of Russia are no longer in a position to turn the clock right back to where it stood when Stalin was in control. Since Khrushchev's day, and we shouldn't underestimate Khrushchev, the change in atmosphere, the all-round relaxation of pressure, have gone too far for that. Mr. Brezhnev, it's true, occupies a position of very great power. But even so, the power he wields is quite different in character from the total power wielded by Stalin. It's true that from time to time there is a tightening up. Purges are undertaken, repressive measures are introduced. But the machine gun is no longer the answer to everything. It's no longer possible to force the lid right back onto Pandora's box. For 25 years and more, human nature has been at work. Human nature, which under Stalin was somehow kept in check, but which, once it's allowed free play, can be one of the most disruptive and subversive forces on earth, and given the chance, can very quickly make hay of any political or ideological or philosophical system, especially one which, like the Soviet system, does not take it sufficiently into account. "I expect you'll notice a change," said the man on the park bench when he heard that I'd known the Soviet Union in Stalin's day. "I'll tell you the biggest change of all. People are beginning to think for themselves." And of course, if you let people think for themselves in some areas, they're very soon going to think for themselves in others as well. There is no more difficult or dangerous operation in politics than that undertaken by Khrushchev. The liberalization, the gradual relaxation of a total dictatorship. He was very lucky or very clever, and the whole thing didn't blow up in his face, as it might well have done. Now he's a non-person, nobody likes him. But he did guide the Soviet Union through what was probably the most dangerous phase in its history. Now, another important development of the past 25 years has been the emergence in Russia of a regular class structure with the usual accompaniment of vested interests, which now play quite as important a part in Russia as they do anywhere else. Under Stalin, the turnover by terror was more rapid. Those in power were automatically in danger and were not given time to dig themselves in as a class. Now this is no longer so. A man born, say, with a century, born in the year 1900, who by the age of 50, by 1950, had managed in any one of a variety of fields to achieve a position of power, responsibility and wealth, a man, say for example, who had become a marshal in the Soviet army. He would, if still alive today, aged 79, almost certainly be living in considerable luxury and would have had no difficulty in launching his children and grandchildren on careers comparable to his own. Had they been the children and grandchildren of a marshal, they would have gone straight into the army, they'd have gone to officers' academies, they'd have gone into guards' regiments, and they would have had none of the problems which lesser people would encounter. And what is more, these children and grandchildren, in their turn, would confidently expect, when the time came, to do the same for their children and their grandchildren. A good start in life in the Soviet Union, as elsewhere, makes a difference, and so, it must be added, does inherited wealth. It's still the job you do that matters, as it does here or in most other countries, but it's a great deal easier to get a good job if your father had a good job before you. In other words, what is emerging 62 years after the Bolshevik Revolution is something of which Russia historically has often felt the lack under the Tsars, namely a firmly established hereditary ruling class. One might almost say an aristocracy. These are the people who earn and keep and bequeath the most money, who travel abroad, who possess the finest apartments and dachas, drive the best and fastest cars, who shop, as of right, in special clothes shops, who wear the smartest clothes, who occupy the most coveted tables in the smartest restaurants and the best seats in the theater, and do all this as of right. Nor do these class distinctions occur only at the highest level. For practically the first time in Russian history, a true middle class is emerging, bringing with them the social stability and all the other bourgeois virtues so sadly lacking under the Tsars, a middle class that can be seen in strength, shopping in GUM, the great department store in opposite the Kremlin, disporting themselves at the better Black Sea resorts, spending their money at the theater and the ballet and the opera, driving their own medium-sized cars out into the country on their days off. They're not as rich or as sophisticated or as self-assured as the upper class, but they know what they want and they have by now an important stake in society. Meanwhile, of course, as under capitalism, there are plentiful opportunities for the working class, the proletariat, if sufficiently shrewd and industrious, to better themselves, to improve their position, and given time and opportunity, to climb to who knows what heights on the social ladder. From personal observation, from chance glimpses behind the scenes, one very quickly comes to realize in the Soviet Union that throughout this whole elaborate structure, a complicated social life is in progress, regulated, as elsewhere, by good or bad luck, by every kind of human motive and emotion, virtue and weakness, by good judgment or bad, by ambition, success or failure, by intrigue or corruption, by poverty or wealth, by idleness, envy or greed. None of which important human factors seem so far to have been eliminated by the changes which have taken place in the Russian political, social and economic system since the revolution. Changes which once used to aim, amongst other things, at the creation of a new Soviet man. There's an awful lot of the old Adam still around in the new Soviet man, such as he is. Now, while in many respects beneficial, this stratification of society must complicate the task of government. What it amounts to is that there are today in the Soviet Union any number of people whose views and requirements have to be taken into account by those in power, who constitute, in other words, an embryonic public opinion. And that, of course, is immensely important. There's another thing. The moment you give people a rather better standard of living, they immediately want a much better one. To anyone who, like myself, knew the Soviet Union of 40 years ago, 42 years ago, the improvement that's taken place in the general standard of living, in the choice and availability of consumer goods, in housing conditions and amenities generally, is positively startling. But this doesn't prevent all these important people from demanding a greater improvement still and going on demanding it. Their wives see to that. The deep-seated desire of Soviet womanhood, especially in the higher social echelons, for greater luxury and glamour and more and better consumer goods, is a force which the ministers concerned, which the party even, simply cannot afford to ignore. The consumer revolution, though it's had its ups and downs, has come to stay. there has been over the years a marked improvement in the position of the consumer vis-a-vis the producer, in political terms of the citizen in relation to the state, because of course the state is the producer. To meet increasingly insistent demands for a better standard of living, the whole balance of the Soviet economy is slowly being altered. Today, in certain fields, something approaching a market economy is coming into being. Goods are now quite often produced because people want them, and not as formerly, simply to fulfill some theoretical norm. There's also, of course, a flourishing, all-pervading black market and a grey market in operation. I was driving along a road in the Ukraine not long ago, and I saw perhaps 100 private cars drawn up by the side of the road. I said to the man I was with, "What's all that?" And he said, "Oh, it's Sunday." So I said, "What happens on Sunday?" Well, on Sunday, all the sailors from the port of Odessa come out into the country to this peasants' market, where the peasants sell their produce, and there they sell off all the radio sets and watches and perfume and nylons and cameras that they have smuggled into the country. And people come from all around in their motor cars to buy them for what they will fetch. Now, of course, if an innocent tourist like myself can see that, the KGB must know about it too, and they either are involved themselves, or they think it better to close their eyes to it. And you find this everywhere. With the consumer revolution, of course, have come other byproducts. None more important than the proliferation of the private automobile, with all the complications which that involves in a country where tight control is of paramount importance. The great Duke of Wellington, who won the Battle of Waterloo and later became Prime Minister, opposed the railways, the introduction of railways in Great Britain, on the grounds that it was a very dangerous thing to increase the mobility of the working class. I think that the Russians could learn from his example. Quite apart from all the parking problems and gasoline problems and car thieves and crime and everything else that comes with the internal combustion engine. Of course, in the same, but of course the big thing is that it increases people's mobility and the privacy that they enjoy. And in the same way, better living accommodation, more apartments of their own, more privacy, a wider choice of goods, more contact, if only indirect, with the outside world, all this make it easier for the ordinary Soviet citizen who feels so inclined to escape total standardization. So that today there's more variety, more diversity in everything, even in lifestyles. Instead of seeing everybody walking along the street all looking exactly the same, you now see all kinds of different types of people in the Soviet Union, and that is another important step forward. Short term, of course, it would probably be possible to spend 2 or 3 years in the Soviet Union, as some newspaper men do, and still take the view that no progress is being made in any of these directions. Indeed, that things are actually getting worse. But if you look back over a much longer period, and if you allow for periodic setbacks and reversals, it's hard to resist. I find it hard to resist the conclusion that long-term progress is being made, that however slowly, a gradual evolution is taking place, that, to paraphrase Lenin, it's a case of three steps forward and two back. What's more, the motive force behind this evolution, or should one perhaps call it revolution, is not the pursuit of any vague, abstract ideas or ideals, but of solid material advantage for those concerned, of what Edmund Burke once called human wants. In other fields, too, things are also moving. Under Stalin, there were no dissidents. Potential dissidents were dealt with by a bullet in the back of the neck. Now, this is no longer so. It's true, of course, that if this or that intellectual oversteps the mark, he's apt to be savagely disciplined. Indeed, by their recent treatment of dissidents, their continuing ill treatment of dissidents, the Soviet government have done a tremendous lot of harm to their public image. But even so, to put it brutally, there's all the difference in the world between 3 or 4 years in a lunatic asylum or even breaking stones in Siberia and actually facing a firing squad. Despite the difficulties, and they're considerable, dissidents hold press conferences, banned books and secret news sheets continue to circulate, contact is maintained with the outside world, people listen to foreign broadcasts, protests are made, pictures are painted, ideas expressed, at any rate in private, which, if not openly subversive, certainly do not conform to the precepts of the party line. There is even, almost unbelievably, an independent, unofficial trade union movement. It's been suppressed more than once, but it's come back again. And this means that for the authorities, for the Soviet authorities, for the Kremlin, the dilemma is fast becoming an awkward one, and policy is now delicately balanced between what can still be safely withheld and what must now be grudgingly granted. Take one little example. Blue jeans. 20 years ago, the first blue jeans were introduced into the Soviet Union by some tourist or other. They were considered a bad thing by the Soviet government, an example of American capitalist influence or whatever. But they kept on coming in, one way or another. They were sold illegally by tourists. And the great thing, the great social symbol, the great status symbol in the Soviet Union for anybody under the age of about 60, were blue jeans. They were exactly the opposite of what they are in the West. Well then, in the end, there was so much smuggling of jeans and such a black market in jeans that the Soviet government had finally to make them, which is what is now happening, under license from American firms. They're now being produced in the Soviet Union. But they still don't like them. They still smuggle them. The price of a Soviet-made pair of jeans is 20 rubles. The price of an imported American Western jeans is 300 rubles. Another thing that they've fought against, unavailingly,
is punk rock. It goes against everything the Soviet Union stands for, or they think it does. But it's fought its way in, and now there is punk rock, there are punk rock concerts and punk rock dancing in the public, in the state parks of rest and culture. I was in the Soviet Union last month. All the young people were the Stars and Stripes or the American Eagle across their T-shirts. Well, now one wonders where these T-shirts come from, how they get in. They do get in, or they're made by somebody, by private enterprise, which there shouldn't be anyway, and they are worn. It's inconceivable that there should be a Soviet state factory making these T-shirts, but they are made. I met a young lady who had the British Royal Arms, the lion and the unicorn, spread across her very well-filled T-shirt. I said to her, "How nice." She said to me, "Yes, it's something American." So I said, "Well, in fact, it isn't." And she was thoroughly mortified. She said, "Oh dear, they told me it was American. And but my jeans are real imported American jeans." Now, these are just a few of the regime's domestic problems. But of course, they're not the only ones. They're quite significant because they go everywhere. They go right against the whole system. But there are more fundamental problems than that. Like other countries, the Soviet Union, more than 60 years after the revolution, still has serious economic difficulties to contend with. They were told that the revolution would do away with all that. It hasn't. Economic growth, bedeviled by the effects of what they call bureaucratic centralism, is disappointing. At present, an American industrial worker produces twice as much as a Soviet industrial worker. And an American farm hand produces 10 times as much as his Soviet counterpart. Soviet agriculture, of course, owing partly to the less than brilliant results of collectivization and also to the very old-fashioned farming methods and again to intolerable climatic conditions, which is nobody's fault, is all too often in trouble. Year after year, the government, as you know here better than anywhere, have had to spend valuable currency on importing grain. But now, perhaps the most revealing fact of all is this, that around 30% of Soviet agricultural produce comes not from state farms or from collective farms, but from the private plots of individual peasants. Now, 30% is produced by these private plots, but those private plots amount to less than 3% of all the agricultural land in the Soviet Union. And that really is the most terrifying indictment of the system. It shows that they're putting all their energies into producing by private enterprise and for very large sums, because what they sell it for what it will fetch, and it's very dear. That is working far more better and far more effectively than nationalized, collectivized agriculture. It's simply, again, a fact of human nature. What is more, the government have to accept that, and they have to build these enormous great markets in every city in the Soviet Union where the peasants can come and sell their own personal produce for what it will fetch. Otherwise, there wouldn't be enough to eat. The international outlook is not very simple for anyone. Perhaps we in the West are inclined to think that it's worse for us than for anybody else, but it isn't simple for the Russians either. Directly or indirectly, the Soviet government holds sway today over a far bigger empire than did the Tsars. This brings its rewards, but it also brings its responsibilities and its problems. Within the frontiers of the Soviet Union, the task of ruling over a varied assortment of subject races is not an easy one. There are all kinds of problems there. Outside its frontiers, the carefully constituted cordon sanitaire of Soviet satellites stretching from the Baltic to the Black Sea and very carefully assembled and put together after World War II. For the last 30 years, it's been a source not so much of reassurance as it was meant to, as of constant concern. Just think back, I mean, during this period, the last 30 years, 35 years, there have been recurrent signs of liberalism, which have made it necessary for the Kremlin to bring pressure to bear on individual satellite governments, one after the other, or even, as in the case of Hungary and Czechoslovakia, to intervene directly by force of arms. Following Yugoslavia's defection in 1948, East Germany, Poland, Hungary, Czechoslovakia, Romania have all at one time or another caused trouble and have all in their different ways still give to this day proof of non-conformity. Even the communist parties of the West, normally totally abject, have on occasion shown some slight signs of independence. Then, of course, for the Russians, an even more serious problem, one of which every Russian you meet, whether it's the editor of Izvestia, whether it's a member of the government, whether it's a man you meet in a bar, a problem of which every one of them is acutely conscious is that of China, Russia's fellow communist colossus and former satellite, looming up on her eastern frontier with what will soon be, maybe is already, a population of 1,000 million brave, dedicated, hard-working, intelligent citizens, looking for somewhere to expand into, and meanwhile missing no opportunity of denouncing in the most insulting terms Russia's fall from grace and cynical betrayal of the revolution. China, for the Russians, is nothing short of a nightmare. Tito's defection, small country, back in 1948, was bad enough. A first crack had appeared in the monolith. The rift with China, widening and deepening with the years, now effectively splits the communist world in two. From every point of view, racial, military, economic, political and ideological, China remains a menace, a perpetual reminder of all the unpleasant things which in the course of Russia's long history have come out at her from the East, a constant threat which, whatever the situation elsewhere, can never for one single instant be left out of sight. As one cynical Russian said to me, there's only one country in the world entirely surrounded by hostile communist states, and that is the Soviet Union. Now, this brings me to the well-worn but nonetheless vital question of East-West relations, which for the past 30 years has held the center of the international stage. During this period, we've experienced, one after the other, Cold War, coexistence, and, of course, more recently, détente. None of them, in practice, very readily distinguishable from the other. Now, in practice, as in theory, everyone must clearly be in favor of détente, if only because the alternative simply does not bear thinking about. To condemn the two halves of the world lightheartedly to perpetual tension, or worse still, to mutual extinction, is scarcely a very constructive proposition. But what is absolutely essential is to determine right from the start exactly what, in present circumstances, is meant by détente. And for this purpose, it's necessary to take a long, hard, and above all, realistic look at the basis and motivation of Soviet policy. Now, this, as I've said, is based on the more or less enlightened self-interest of a superpower, with as its immediate aim the safeguarding of its own security, and as its ultimate theoretical purpose, world domination, or to put it in another way, world revolution. Today there are signs that the Russians are anxious, genuinely anxious, for a measure of détente. Undoubtedly, they would welcome a respite in which to mend their fences, recover their equilibrium, and most important of all, to obtain from the West the financial, economic, and technological assistance which at this stage of their development they still require. What from a Western point of view would be entirely erroneous, entirely mistaken, would be to imagine that their desire for détente springs from some sudden feeling of benevolence towards the capitalist world. On the contrary, the Russians are still, in theory, pledged to the overthrow of capitalism everywhere. And this they demonstrate in practice by the rate at which they continue to build up their armaments, both nuclear and conventional. Soviet sea power, wrote Admiral Gorshkov recently, has become the optimum means to defeat the imperialist enemy and the most important element in the Soviet arsenal to prepare the way for a communist world. Nothing surely could be clearer than that. Now, the purpose of these vast and rapidly increasing armaments, and in particular of the recent enormous increase in Soviet naval strength, to which Admiral Gorshkov, who brought it about, refers, is in one sense military. In another very important sense, it is political and ideological. They are not just intended for use in case of war. They're primarily intended for constant use in peacetime as a political weapon, a means of bringing pressure designed to further Soviet interests in any and every part of the world. Of late, this tendency has been more in evidence than ever, notably in Africa, to mention only one part of the world. It would therefore be very foolish for us to ignore it, especially when the Russians keep repeating themselves, quite frankly, that their present policy of cooperation with the West does not mean that they're abandoning their efforts to change what they call the balance of social political forces in the world. This, we can be quite sure, is an aim which, détente or no détente, they will continue to pursue for the foreseeable future, sometimes by subversion, sometimes by financial or economic means, sometimes by the use of Cuban or other mercenaries, and sometimes by more or less direct intervention or confrontation. In the hope, no doubt, that if they keep it up, if they persevere, the West and much else besides will eventually fall into their lap like a ripe plum, as foretold by the prophets of Marxism, in whom they still believe. Now, for us in the West, their attitude should certainly not come as a surprise. Nor should we allow ourselves to be lulled into thinking that because there's so much talk of détente, we can safely sit back and relax. Nor, in all seriousness, can we afford to ignore the danger that if, as seems all too possible, we allow the balance of power to shift too drastically to our disadvantage. The Soviet government or their military advisers could consider this a sufficient reason for seeking to settle with us once and for all. Though here, I think, to be fair, we should be clear that in the Russians, we are contending at present with cautious realists rather than with power-crazed maniacs like Hitler. What then should be the Western attitude towards détente? It seems evident that we should not reject the idea of détente as such. But to my mind, it's no less evident that we should approach it with great wariness and even greater realism. In the ultimate analysis, the Soviet Union still needs détente at least as much as the West. The Western powers are therefore, if they play their cards right, they're in a position to insist on terms which would make it worthwhile for them. I think this is what Dr. Kissinger calls linkage, and I think it's very important, should be, in return. Quite obviously, it must be ridiculous for us to provide the Russians with all the credits and grain and advanced industrial plant and technological know-how and get nothing worth having in return. Nor could it make sense for us to bolster up the Soviet economy simply in order to help the Russians spend even more on armaments. Now, what can we hope to gain from détente? Clearly, the most worthwhile thing of all would be a measure of genuine disarmament on the part of the Soviet Union. But we should be quite clear about one thing. Without at least equivalent reductions on the Soviet side, any unilateral disarmament on the part of the West would be sheer lunacy. So long as the Russians maintain their present level of armaments, it's obviously essential that the Western powers should at all costs maintain, or better still, increase their present somewhat inadequate armed capacity, especially in the field of conventional weapons, because conventional weapons are what are likely to decide the issue in any crisis. Nor, I believe, should we simply accept as inevitable any further Soviet encroachment worldwide. It's simply a question of knowing where to draw the line, and, I hasten to add, of being able to draw it, which we can only do if we're strong. As Lord Palmerston, in his way, a considerable statesman, said more than a century ago, the policy and practice of the Russian government has always been to push forward its encroachments as far and as fast as the apathy or want of firmness of other governments would allow it to go, but always to stop and retire when it met with decided resistance. I think that that should be written up on a bit of paper in front of every statesman, every Western statesman today, because it's just as true, and it's another proof of continuity of Soviet policy, it's just as true today as when he wrote it or said it more than 100 years ago. We should remember that the Russians did not keep their rockets in Cuba in 1962. When they were stopped, they pulled back. Now, I believe that there are also advantages to be gained by the West in other areas. Stalin, who certainly gave the whole matter considerable thought, was clearly convinced that to maintain adequate control over the peoples of the Soviet Union, it was necessary to keep them as far as possible protected from contact
with the outside world. Since his day, the barriers between East and West have to some extent been broken down. So have the pressures designed to prevent the Soviet peoples from thinking for themselves. As I've tried to show, other influences, notably human nature, have been at work in a rather more favorable atmosphere. Influences calculated in the long run to transform the Soviet Union into something a little less difficult to live with. And nothing, I believe, will accelerate this process more than freer contact of all kinds between East and West. Though they are proud of their country and prepared to fight bravely in defense of it, as they did in the two world wars, the Soviet people certainly do not want war. How could they after all the sufferings they endured in the last two world wars? I believe that as time goes on and as they have a little more say in the conduct of their affairs, the pressures on the Soviet government in favor of peace and of genuine détente with the West will increase rather than diminish. I may be optimistic, but that's what I think. You've got to remember that the conflict between East and West is first and foremost a conflict of ideas. The Russians are taught to believe as absolute dogma that our system, the Western capitalist democratic system, whatever you like to call it, carries within it the seeds of its own decay and is therefore doomed. Personally, I believe that on the contrary, our Western democratic ideas are far better and far stronger than theirs. And given the chance, are bound to prevail in the end. In fact, in many parts of the world, including Russia itself in a small way, one can see signs that this is already happening. Which is why détente and the greater freedom of intercourse it should bring with it is a challenge which we in the West cannot refuse, because to do so would show lack of confidence in ourselves and our own values. What's important is that in pursuing this policy, the West should never weaken, whether militarily or politically, economically or ideologically, that we should have confidence in ourselves and the courage of our own convictions, that we should keep our wits about us and on no account lower our guard. In other words, that we should be as tough and as resilient as the Russians, if not tougher. Weakness is something that the Russians despise. Strength they understand and admire. Any sign of weakness on our part directly nurtures Soviet aggressiveness by increasing the danger of power passing in the Soviet Union to men hell-bent on war. A more robust attitude, on the other hand, wins respect, shakes any belief in our decline, and improves the prospects of genuine understanding. And here it's perhaps useful, in conclusion, to recall that there have been other apparently insoluble conflicts and confrontations in history over the centuries, and that with the passing of time, the original cause of conflict has as often as not disappeared and been in the end forgotten. Without being unduly optimistic, there seems to me at any rate a chance that this could happen in the present instance. With time, experience shows the steam goes out of crusades, but it never goes out of human nature. And human nature, I can assure you, is at the present time very hard at work in Russia.
We've got time for questions, and I'm going to ask Sir Fitzroy to go to lecture room 6 first and answer a few questions there. And if all goes well, we should hear them here.
Thank you.
Eric Vogel.
Thank you. We can have a couple of questions in here. I'll ask whoever is asking the question to come forward so people in the other room can hear the question too. Who wants to start? Yes, please come forward. And speak into the microphone.
Sir Fitzroy, I was in Russia earlier this year and I had the feeling the whole time that they had an inferiority complex, more or less, and were trying to prove themselves. Was this a wrong impression I got? Or do you think it's probably quite true?
I think it could be true.
You're speaking to the...
Sorry, what's your speaking?
I think that could be true. They've got a mixture of an inferiority and a superiority complex, and we know how that makes individuals behave sometimes, and I think the same could be true of the whole country.
Next question. Yes, over here, please. Please, Jeff, come forward and speak into the microphone.
Sir Fitzroy, you say we have to remain firm with Russia, especially as far as our defences are concerned. I'd like to know where you draw the line between remaining firm and devoting an ever-increasing percentage, even, of gross national product to defences the way the military seem to be demanding of us. They're not even satisfied to have the same percentage of investment in defence. They want to increase it by 3% every year for I'm not quite sure how long. Now, the level of expenditure on defence seems to me to be simply increasing, obviously, the sophistication of the weapons as well, rather uncontrollably, and people expressing sentiments like those you're expressing tonight only seem to be encouraging this rather unrestrained development.
Well, I think that we should do two things. One is to go all out for mutual disarmament with the Russians. But it must be mutual, and it must be balanced, and it must be genuine. The Russians are spending a lot on armaments too. There is pressure, not so much pressure, but pressure of a kind on the Soviet government to spend more on consumer goods, as there is here. Sooner or later, I think they will get the message, and if they get a genuine offer of disarmament on our part, they will take it seriously. But what to me seems enormously dangerous is to let them get or remain ahead of us. Because I think, for exactly the same reason, we had all these arguments. None of you, or very few of you, are old enough to remember, but we had all these same arguments before the war when it was Germany rearming. And people then said, fancy spending money on armaments. But the fact is that when Hitler got strong enough, he started the war. And we don't want to have the Russians exposed to that same temptation. At the moment, we know that in conventional forces, which are enormously important because that is what people are likely to use, in conventional forces, the Russians have great superiority over NATO. They now seem to have nuclear parity. Well, if anything could encourage them to be aggressive, it's that situation. And as long as it lasts, it's extremely dangerous. I don't think that they, I mean, as I said in the course of my remarks, we're not dealing with power-crazed maniacs like Hitler. We're dealing with fairly cautious realists. And if we had 5% superiority over them, I wouldn't give the whole thing another thought. I wouldn't think we need to worry at all. But when they have 5 or 10%, when they have enormous superiority over us in conventional weapons and parity in nuclear weapons, I think it's a very dangerous state of affairs indeed. And one has to remember, I mean, it's a glimpse of the obvious, but if you spend, if a community, a society spends all its money on having a good time and on consumer weapons, and they thereby encourage the other side to attack them, well, all the consumer weapons and the nice standard of living and everything else gets swept away as it did in the last war.
Do we have time for perhaps one very quick question, if there is one?
Sir Fitzroy, I sort of agree with a lot of your impressions having been in the Soviet Union. Given your statement that class structure is solidifying in the Soviet Union, and given the fact that top class structures would receive greater material benefits, you'd give somewhat of an impression that this would help us between the West and East help understand each other. But I give you the point that the aristocracy of today, which didn't live through Stalinist times, which you yourself saw, would make it a much more authoritarian future government that threatens Soviet Union's further development. And how would you respond to that?
Well, I'd say that you couldn't have a more authoritarian form of government than Stalin managed to establish. I also think that I'm not thinking particularly that a lot of Russian aristocrats will talk in a friendly way to a lot of Western aristocrats. That's not what I had in mind. What I do think is that a system where you've got one man with total power over 300 million people, it's an extremely dangerous state of affairs. I think that there's a lot to be said for having a lot of people in a country with vested interests, with stability, because I think they're less likely to risk the whole thing in a war. They're also less likely to become desperate, because it doesn't matter to them whether they're dead or alive. I think there's a lot to be said for a bourgeoisie. It's slightly ironical, and it should make poor Lenin turn in his little glass case. To think that 62 years after the Bolshevik Revolution, his most considerable achievement is to have created a bourgeoisie which didn't exist under the Tsars. But even so, I don't think it's a bad thing for the Soviet Union. I don't think it's a bad thing for the rest of the world.
Thank you very much. We're going to have to return to the other room, but thank you.
I hope they didn't get lost. Please speak clearly and make your questions brief. Thank you very much. Yes, sir.
Do you think that the Soviets will take advantage of the increasing chaos in Iran to move more firmly into there? And if so, what would the response of the West be?
Can you repeat the question?
Do I think that the Russians are likely to take advantage of the increasing chaos in Iran? And how's it likely to turn out? I think if they thought that they could turn the existing chaos to their advantage, they would do so. I don't think it's an entirely easy thing to do. I don't think it's very easy for anybody to do anything much about Iran. I suppose that if the chaos became too great, they might find it necessary to occupy northern Persia, which is quite easy thing for them to do, in order to safeguard their own interests, or that is what they would say. I also think that it's quite possible that the present Iranian government could be overthrown, and that a pro-Soviet, a communist government of some kind could take its place. But I can't look into the future more than that. I don't think many people can. And I'm very glad I'm not President Carter at the moment.
Yes, sir.
Sir Fitzroy, should the American Senate ratify the SALT II agreements in Europe?
Should they? Quite frankly, it's a very, very complicated subject, and I am not sufficiently well informed to say whether at any given moment, on any given set of conditions, they should ratify it or not. The conditions, if I knew about it, what I would say is this, that providing that the agreed reductions are genuinely mutual and genuinely balanced, then it's a good thing, because it saves both countries from wasting a lot of money on armaments when they could be spending it on something more productive. But one hears people say, and I don't know how much truth there is in this, that it would leave Europe unprotected. And I think that for the Americans to do that would be absolutely crazy. It would be asking for trouble. But in considering any problem like this, I would always apply that criterion, that we must, and I think it's what Dr. Kissinger has called linkage, that you must get as good as you give, at least as good as you give, preferably a little more than you give.
Yes, ma'am.
In that case, since we must get as good as we give,
the question is, what should we demand in return for the cheap grain, the loans, and the technological equipment that we let them have? I think we should demand genuine disarmament. I think that's the only thing we want from the Russians. It's a very alarming, to my mind, it's a very, very alarming situation when they have this enormous preponderance of conventional weapons and a relative parity in nuclear weapons.
Parity nuclear weapons. Besides, there is 4.5 times more explosive power than in ours. That does not mean that it is 4.5 times more effective, but it is significantly more effective.
I'm very interested indeed to hear you say that, and I'm sure you speak with much more authority than I do, but that really simply confirms what I'm saying, is that we must not let ourselves go too far behind. I haven't been a member of the government for years, and I don't know the details of these things.
But to be told by an expert that in fact we not only are miles behind in conventional forces but are also miles behind in nuclear forces makes my hair stand on end.
Yes, sir.
If you kindly comment on Helsinki Accord, if we can still expect that anything but the relaxation
Well, I have never been able to understand why the Russians signed the Helsinki Accord. It seems to me that for once they didn't really manage to get a very good deal, because in fact what the West did was to recognize the status quo. Now, a lot of people would say that it would be nice if the West could liberate Poland and the Baltic states and so on. But that, in fact, is not likely. And that is what the West gave away, their recognition of the status quo. Now, what did we get in return? We got recognition from the Russians of, to use a package phrase, human rights. Now, I think, from my knowledge of Russia, which goes back a long way, that it's very, very difficult for the Russians to genuinely implement, even if they wanted to. It would be very, very difficult with our present system to grant human rights in the way we have them in the West. But they have put their signature to this. The result of that has been that they are pilloried by everybody all over the world for not granting something which they have no intention of doing and couldn't do if they wanted to. And from a propaganda point of view, I think that means a very big disadvantage to them. What should our attitude be? I think we should go, perhaps a little unkindly, but go on pressing them to give what they undertook to give at every possible advantage, free movement of people, free movement of ideas, and so on. And I think it's fair to say that there have been, of late, signs that they might be very, very slowly moving in that direction. If that is so, it's a very good thing and a very important score for us.
Yes, sir.
Thank you very much for your very interesting lecture. From what I heard of it, I was thinking that possibly
question.
I'd like to pose my question, first of all, as a brief statement, and have you comment on the statement.
Well, make it brief, though.
Brief. Most of the subjects that you discussed and the relationships between them seem to lack the one ultimate expression of the conflict between East and West, whereas the Western world is not articulate enough in demonstrating its faith in freedom rather than democracy, seeing as democracy has now been subverted, that the Western world should unite together one faith, and that faith being the faith of freedom.
What is the question?
The question is, what do you think about the Western world's philosophical and moral position, and how do you feel about the concept of the faith of freedom? Freedom as a faith rather than a concept or as a virtue.
Well, you heard that question. I think that my feeling towards our own system, whatever you like to call it, parliamentary democracy in one form or another,
and as much freedom as one can have without impinging on people's rights. I feel what Winston Churchill said about it, which is, it's a terrible system, but it's less awful than all the others.
Which is, in my opinion, most important, as our Western news media, radio and television, seemingly are very, very timid to bring those nationalities programs which could split internally Soviet Russia, as presently the Russians themselves are a minority in Soviet Russia. I need to emphasize that.
But, in fact, you missed what I did have to say about it, which was that the job of keeping together a multiracial state was one of the many problems the Russians have to face up to. That, I think, is perfectly true, and I think there are undoubtedly, and the Russians think so too, nationalist tendencies in the Ukraine, in the Caucasus, in Central Asia. I don't think that one should exaggerate those, because in quite a lot of countries, I'm not personally, although I'm a loyal Scot, I am not a Scottish separatist. And I view separatism in other countries with caution. personally, I mean, I think that it's much better for Scotland to be part of the United Kingdom from point of view of interest as well as from point of view of loyalty or anything else. I don't think there's much future in the world for little countries of 5 million people. Some can get away with it, but others can't. I don't know really how well the Georgians or the Armenians would manage. In some of the countries in the Soviet Union, in Central Asia, for example, they have on the whole a better time than they did under the Emir of Bukhara or whoever ruled over them before. And they've even derived certain benefits, material benefits, from being part of the Soviet Union. The other thing is, I think is illustrated by something that the Russian poet, admittedly Russian, poet Lermontov said when he was fighting in the Caucasus, one day, I paraphrase it, all these people will be slaves of Russia, but they will rejoice in being the slaves of the greatest power on earth. Very typical Russian remark, of course, and made, as I say, there's continuity in these things, made 150 or more years ago. Now, that is to some extent true. Just in the same way that at one time people got a certain kick out of being part of the British Empire. There are a lot of people who get a kick out of being part of the Soviet Empire, so that it isn't everybody. The party members in all these countries are very loyal supporters of the Soviet Union. This doesn't mean that there aren't nationalist tendencies, but there are. But I don't think it's something that we should count on too much.
Yes, sir.
When I was over in Russia about 10 years ago, I noticed the same trouble that I've heard about in Pakistan and so on. The working classes are trying to steal the cement out of concrete and sell it in the black market. And then again, they are so far ahead in missiles like the USS 20 and so on, which is real threat to Europe. Is there any improvement in this attitude of the lower classes? As long as they feel they can pilfer from the state or start construct things that you can push over with your hand.
Could I deal with those two points separately? The SS-20 is, I gather, a very effective weapon which would make it very uncomfortable for Western Europe if it were used against us. Now, that is the sort of thing that has to be taken into account in the SALT talks. That is one of the reasons why it would be disastrous if the Americans were simply to forget about Western Europe. The Russians are complaining very much at the moment because of the proposals to strengthen nuclear armaments in Western Europe. And that convinces me that it's absolutely essential that we should do precisely that.
I'll take two more questions.
Well, no, I'm sorry. I've just got the other half of that question, which strikes me as a very important one. There is a tremendous... The question was, do workmen steal materials and all that at work and use it for their own purposes? There is a complete economy, what they call nalevo on the left, moonlighters, grey market, black market. The only way, and I'm afraid this is also true of other countries, the only way in which you can get something built or something painted or your electrics fixed or your plumbing done is by moonlighters, by people using probably state material on their own account and working in what should be state time for private people. And there's the most elaborate possible system going on. The whole country is riddled with it. That, again, is human nature. But it is attaining the most alarming proportions. There's a terrific lot of pilfering. They come down on it. I mean, just one can find out about it by reading the Soviet press. But it is on a very, very alarming scale. And there's no doubt that a great many Soviet workers are not working at all hard, at any rate, for the state, but they're working quite hard on their own account and making an awful lot of money, which are now beginning to have something to spend on.
Yes, madam.
I think that's a very valid point. It really is that the question, I'm just going to put it, the question is, has there not been over the last 10 years, in fact it's longer than that, a resurgence of great Russian nationalism? And could you just remind me of how you went on?
Obviously get the expression of it must have some kind of at least acquiescence among taught people.
And does it not have the approval of the party? Now, I think that it's very true that there is a very great resurgence of great Russian nationalism, very powerful. I'm quite certain that it has the approval of the party. What I felt, and I've been in the Soviet Union 8 times in the last 3 years. What I feel is that their historical sense is developing very strongly, that they feel themselves more and more at one with characters like Peter the Great and Ivan the Terrible.
that I think that probably something is going on in their relations with the Orthodox Church. Stalin did a deal with the Orthodox Church in 1941 because he knew that it was necessary to have its support in a national war, in an emergency. Now, I think there's a second phase of that is happening now. I think that there's a certain religious resurgence, but at the same time, it's a national resurgence, and the church and the system are coming a bit closer together. I think that at the same time, the revolution, people are beginning to realize that the revolution is 62 years ago. I mean, it's there in the background, they pay lip service to it, but it is a long time ago.
I guess I want to know if you thought it was anti-Western in the same way that
19th century Slavophilia. Yes, oh, absolutely. It's anti-Western. It's the feeling that the Russians are the chosen race and that they have a mission to reform the world, or anyhow to teach the world a lesson. And I think all those ideas are coming back and have considerable popular support. On the other hand, the gentleman who asked a question up there about the nationalities, there was quite an interesting example of that the other day when they suddenly stopped treating Georgian as the official language in Georgia and tried to substitute Russian. And there was such an uproar that they had to change their mind in a hurry. But that again is great Russian. Some of the other republics would have put up with it, but the Georgians are more resilient.
Last question.
Sir Fitzroy, the state of political tension in the Soviet Union has been described metaphorically as freeze and thaw. And I was wondering whether, in your opinion, at the moment we're in a state of freeze or thaw. I've just come back from an international conference where on a scientific topic where the Russians failed to appear, and I was wondering about that had anything to do with the freeze and thaw phenomenon.
Freeze or fog?
Thaw.
I don't know. I misheard. I thought it was freeze or fog. And my answer to that would have been both. But I think it's probably the same answer as to whether it's freeze or thaw. Because I think what happens, as it happens in weather, is that it freezes and then it thaws and then it freezes on top of the thaw, and that makes it more dangerous still. I don't know. I think that, as I said in the course of my remarks, I think that it's evolving. I think things are moving in the Soviet Union. Sometimes they move in a good direction, sometimes they move in a bad direction, but something is happening. I mean, Stalin managed to keep the whole thing frozen tight for 30 years. But I think it is moving. But I don't think that we should draw too many conclusions from that, except a general feeling that it may get a little less difficult to live with if the movement turns out to be in the right direction, which I personally think quite a lot of the time it is. But then one goes back to the Soviet Union and find that it's all tightened up again, it isn't moving. But I still think that on the whole, one should be encouraged by such evolution as is taking place there.
I would call on the Chancellor of the University, the Honorable J.V. Klein, to thank Sir Fitzroy.
Chairman, ladies and gentlemen, Farewell, Eson Yakun. Well, since I have not received any response to that statement,